Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're doing a year in review from the largest single-day protest in American history, the Women's March on Washington, which happened in January, to the Tribune's naming Senator Orrin Hatch Utahn of the Year just this week. And here to talk about this tumultuous and interesting year, we've got an all-opinion crew in studio with us today. Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor George Pyle is here. George, good morning.
Welcome. Good morning.
Thanks for being here in the midst of so many other media appearances.
Well, I saved the best for last.
All right. Editorial writer Michelle Quist, thanks to you for being here once again as well.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Columnist Robert Gerke is here in studio. I'm glad you're here, Robert.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And we also have columnist Holly Richardson. Holly on the Hill, as some of you probably know her. Welcome, Holly.
Thanks for having me.
What were the most important stories of the year in your mind? Let us know. Post your comments or questions at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We could go chronologically here, but I think I'll jump into some news from just this week. The Salt Lake Tribune named Senator Orrin Hatch Utahn of the Year. This was in a profile that came out on Christmas Day. In addition to that profile, the Tribune wrote an editorial explaining the decision, and we've got some members of the editorial board here with us. I'll start with George Pyle, editor of the editorial page. How was the Utahn of the Year decision made, George?
Was that just this week? It seems like it's been months. The Utahn of the Year is something that we have done every year for quite some time now, and it's kind of one of those about the only time of the year where the newsroom, the news editors, and the editorial page staff kind of stand on top of that wall that's supposed to separate us and talk about it. Yeah. And it becomes, who or sometimes what in the past year in Utah made the most news, had the most influence, did the most lasting good or damage in Utah for Utahns. And this time, particularly after the decision was made that the person who best fit that definition was our extremely senior Senator Orrin Hatch, the decision was made by people above my pay grade that, and we've done this sometimes in the past too, just to make it abundantly clear with an editorial,
right,
that the honorific is not necessarily honorable, that there are, you can be the most influential, you can be the most impactful, you can be the most newsworthy without being worthy. You could have done things that were bad, and that makes you the most important. And we tried to make clear in the editorial, although the editorial board had supported the tax bill that Orrin Hatch was such a big part of because of the belief that the corporate tax cuts were overdue. I mean, even Barack Obama was in favor of some form of that. Mm-hmm. But we were very much on the other side of the table when it came to a couple of other things that Senator Hatch was attached to, the most recent and most obvious being the rollback of the two large national monuments that are in Utah, where he convinced the president to do that, or he took credit, and the president gave him credit,
right,
for moving that process along and making such a huge difference, whereas so many of the other monuments that were part of that review, most of them wound up not changing or changing very little, and the Secretary Zinke now is going around looking to add more monuments in other places. But here, these were cut back substantially. We thought he was very wrong about that. And the other thing being that 6 years ago, he told everybody that vote for me one more time, I'll accomplish all this stuff I promised that I would accomplish 3 terms ago, and then we'll all call it quits. And so, you know, he basically froze the field of everybody in Utah who might have succeeded him or even run against him, because he's so influential with name recognition, with fundraising ability, with organization, that to challenge him, especially if you don't totally know when he's going to run, and
it becomes kind of impossible.
It becomes impossible for anybody to mount a challenge.
The three bullet points in the editorial, and they were that, as you said, Hatch played a big role in dismantling national monuments, that as chair of the Senate Finance Committee, he helped pass this enormous tax bill. And then, and this one was, again, the kicker for me, and I'll quote now, his utter lack of integrity that rises from his unquenchable thirst for power, unquote. That is not pulling punches, George. That is the editorial board really making a strong statement.
Yes, yeah. That was That was a pretty strong statement, even for us, yeah. even for an editorial. But again, we didn't want to leave any doubt that when the front page profile that was pretty straightforward, that said he's had the most influence over the year, you know, for reasons 1, 2, and 3, and the editorial was an added way of explaining, you know, being influential is not necessarily being good.
There were a number of people, and the senator included, well, staff member of the senator, yeah. I guess, who saw that the Tribune had named Hatch Utahn of the Year and then maybe potentially misinterpreted what this meant. And, yeah. and this was something the Tribune must have predicted by writing this editorial explaining yeah. why they were naming Hatch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and the senator's staff, I mean, they were not the only people to make that mistake. I mean, you look at the national media, the websites, Wonkette, Politico, all these things, and you'd think that people in the media could tell the difference between a news story and an editorial, but they can't always. This is where I have some sympathy for the weapons enthusiasts who won't talk to you if they think you don't know the difference between a clip and a magazine. You know, if they exclude you from the conversation, well, I get...
The same with editorials.
If they can't tell the difference between a news story and an editorial in a column... I've been fighting this fight for 40 years, and I don't think it's ever going to go away. But, and so a lot of people, they said, oh, he wants you to read the story. Obviously, he didn't read the story.
Yeah.
Well, he did read the story, but they didn't read the editorial, maybe. And when you look at it online, it's different from in print. And these things, even though they're labeled, you can get one mixed up with the other.
Sure.
And so I've spent the last 4 days in various national media forums trying to explain to people the difference between a news story and an editorial. I don't know how much impact I've had.
I want to go to Michelle Quist. Michelle, impact is the key word here, for better or for worse, as George has laid out. Senator Hatch was a big player in 2017.
Right.
I guess, did you play a role in making the decision on Man of the Year at the Tribune? And what do you make of it, I guess?
Well, the editorial board and top news editors talked about who, you know, we thought could be considered, and obviously that was a hard decision. But, you know, his impact was huge. I mean, you know, just taking the senatorial run in and of itself, if he runs again, he has, like George said, you know, taken this position for so many years. I mean, he'll be 90 at the end of a term, and, you know, likely probably wouldn't finish that term out. So then you've got the impact of another campaign that's off season, that's more money. I mean, it's just constant.
You have expressed a hope that Mitt Romney will step in and run for Hatch's seat, whether or not the senator decides to run, right? I mean, in a column in the past, you've done this.
Because at the time, I mean, it's January and signatures start in 4 days, and there are few people that could primary Senator Hatch and be successful. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney could do it, and I wouldn't see him in that position long term.
Part of the context here is, as you said, Senator Hatch could, you know, he's already 40 years in office. It's another 6 years. Maybe I'll turn this to Robert Gerke. We're all sort of waiting on tenterhooks to find out whether or not Senator Hatch is going to run. What about your thoughts on what the future might hold for Hatch, Robert Gerke?
Well, I think he's going to run again. I think he's played it pretty well with his I think I made the comparison earlier on this program where, you know, it's like a mice and men where Hatch is weak. He could be challenged. He could be beaten in a primary. So he's sort of like George and Lenny. You know, he's using Mitt Romney as Lenny to kind of protect himself and keep other people out of the race so he can reserve his option to run. And I think he's dragged it on long enough now. It's pretty clear that he's going to run, and there's some frustration in the Romney camp about that, obviously. Yeah, but I mean, I agree. I mean, I think they made the right call. I think in terms of impact, the only greater impact you could have on the state is if an asteroid hit it, and that wouldn't necessarily be good either. And so, but yeah, there's no question it was a big year for Orrin Hatch. And in terms of all of the news that was in our paper, I think he was the most frequent player in the big stories.
Okay, we've heard from all but Holly Richardson here, and Holly, you've been a political observer and participant, obviously, for a number of years now. Hatch's impact on 2017, and your thoughts on his future and legacy?
Well, I have maybe a little bit of a different perspective. I helped run the campaign for Dan Lilienquist 6 years ago,
right
where Senator Hatch has about every 6 years, the year before his election, he has a pretty good year. He actually gets some stuff done and reaches out to the state of Utah. Is he going to run again? I'm not 100% sure, because here's the deal. He can go out on top if he does not run again and say, I got all these things done. I'm leaving as the chair of the Finance Committee. I got tax reform done. I shrank the national monuments. If he stays in office, I think it's likely that the Republicans lose the Senate and he loses his position as chairman of that committee. And so this is kind of the peak. So I'm wondering if he wants to leave on top.
Go out on a high note.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
George Pyle, the Tribune had, you know, as we said, these critical words for Hatch. That story ballooned into a kind of big story this week. As you see, you know, you've made a bunch of national appearances in national media. Why is there so much media interest in the Salt Lake Tribune having critical words for Senator Hatch?
Well, partly it's the end of the year, and there's not much going on, and especially the cable news networks are hungry for anything to talk about. You know, it's a giant monster you've got to feed all the time. And also, I mean, the same thing happened when we endorsed Barack Obama over Mitt Romney, whenever that was, 6 years ago, when people thought, what? The newspaper in Salt Lake City, Utah, didn't endorse Mitt Romney. And so we were on the BBC and we were on everything explaining that to people, too.
There's a shock that the big daily in Utah wouldn't necessarily be aligned with the political establishment in the state.
And you know, and then since then, we didn't endorse Mitt Romney for president, but now we've suggested that everybody would be better off if he ran for the Senate. So, you know, everybody has their niche. But yeah, and people are surprised. And this is, you know, this is kind of too bad. People parachute into a state when something interesting seems to have happened, and then something else shiny occurs to them, and they're off somewhere else. So, you know, I made the most of it while I could, and that's probably the end of that.
Let me just jump in in defense of Orrin Hatch. I'm not sure that Mitt Romney's the answer to this question either, because you're trading a guy who's 80 years old with a lot of seniority accrued, Senate Finance Chairman, for a guy who'd be in his mid-70s when he starts his first term and is the juniorest of junior senators in the Senate and can't get anything done. So I think this you know, love of Mitt Romney is a little bit overblown.
Well, and we haven't really talked about, I mean, Senator Hatch has had this important role, as we've pointed out. Yeah. And I don't know if that's an argument for him running again or not, but there it is. Guys, we have got so many, we've got a year's worth of stories to cover and not a lot of time. And so we should move on to other things. Huge this year, maybe kind of the story of 2017 nationwide, the Me Too movement, in which women, largely women but also men, outed themselves as survivors of sexual harassment or assault, a kind of collective cry of enough is enough. Each of you wrote about this. I think I'll start with you, Holly Richardson. You wrote about the Me Too movement soon after the hashtag went viral in October. You shared your own stories, actually, and then you made an appeal for action that we hear believers, that we hear and believe victims. Sorry,
sure.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Sure. So I do think that the Me Too movement is one of the biggest stories and movements of the year, and I am glad to see that it still has legs, that it's still being talked about, it's still being covered. I think one of the things that's concerning is the potential backlash against both people who say that they have been victims of sexual assault or harassment, and people who might worry that those accusations are going to be used as political weapons. So I would say, first of all, rape and sexual assault have always been weapons, right? They've been used as weapons of war for as long as humans have been alive, I'm sure. And they've only been recognized as such really in the last couple of decades. But it's the accusations, right? It's looking at the Roy Moore race, where his supporters believe that there were 9 women who got together and concocted fake stories to take him down, right? They don't believe that those stories were true, that there was any validity to the fact that he was trying to date 14-year-olds when he was in his 30s. So I think that there is some backlash that's coming. I do know from friends of mine that are on Utah's Capitol Hill that there are male legislators right now who are saying, I will no longer take a female intern because I want to avoid the quote very appearance of evil, so I will not have a female intern. And so now what we see is a reaction to this voicing of discrimination is an increase in discrimination.
Discrimination itself. Yeah. Wow. That's a pretty shocking thing to hear because...
Yeah. There are three legislators up there that I know of who follow the Pence rule. They won't have a meeting with a female lobbyist or colleague without their wife in the room. Oh. And so this is something that's been going on. This predated the Me Too movement, but it's going to be more pervasive, I think, in the coming year.
Part of the conversation at the upcoming session, I'm sure. Michelle Quist, I want to turn to you. You've also written about the prevalence of, you know, sexual harassment and assault against women, and you've talked about the willingness to kind of shrug it off.
Yeah.
For example, you point to the fact that so many people around Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. Knew what he was doing and enabled it by kind of looking the other way.
Right. They knew. Everybody knew. And they didn't do anything about it. And I think as the Me Too movement grew and men and women read accounts of their friends and their sisters and even their mothers of things that happened to their own family, you know, whether it be all the way abusive situations or harassment. You know, the fact that we say just harassment is the problem. We don't want to be catcalled on the street anymore. It's not the way our society should be moving forward. And I think as the Me Too movement grew and as it continues to grow, that people are starting to understand that we can't act that way anymore.
And is that, I mean, part of the... You want to see the story kept alive,
yeah.
Obviously. I mean, that's an antidote to this, maybe,
is
to keep it in the public eye.
Yes, because like you had said before, half of it is the people around you that see it happening.
So I'll just give you this example. I've been in several rooms full of women at conferences in the last month where people have asked, the speakers have asked, how many of you have your own Me Too story? And I'm telling you, virtually every woman in that room have raised their hand.
Yep.
And then when they ask, how many of you have spoken publicly about it, we're at about 10%. Right. So there it is prevalent. It is everywhere. And people don't want to know that it's everywhere. But I think you had to get to that tipping point, right, mm-hmm. where you finally have enough people talking about it. There were people talking about Weinstein who did know and they looked the other way. It's the same on Utah's Capitol Hill. There have been people who have been placing interns for years who know that there are people you cannot place interns with. You cannot place female interns with certain legislators because of a history of sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. They know it. The Salt Lake Tribune wrote about it in one of the articles about the Me Too movement, right? But it's that tipping point where you start to have this snowball roll down the hill.
And all of you have written about the need for victims to be believed. Sexual assault survivors often face kind of absurd questions about, you know, how they instigated this. Robert Gerke, you also wrote about this, your own experiences as an adolescent, and about the need to lead by example and refuse to look the other way.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this is the women coming forward. I think the other part of it is people willing to listen. And so there's got to be a receptive audience, I guess, and there's also got to be a support network there for people to come forward. Because a lot of times the reason, I think particularly in our culture, the reason they don't come forward is because they feel like they're going to be shunned or they're going to be viewed suspiciously. And we saw this frequently when we were talking about the BYU rape cases that the Tribune won the Pulitzer for last year. And so I think it dovetails right with that. There's got to be a network of support there for them. They've got to be received, welcomed, not shunned. And they've got to have a receptive audience there as well.
And the stigma has to go
away. And the stigma has to go away. Now, I think going to what Holly was saying about the backlash, the potential for a backlash, I think we're kind of maybe already seeing some of that start moving the other way. Now, there was a poll that was released yesterday that said that 54% of Minnesotans didn't want Al Franken to resign, even though the Democratic establishment was quick to force him out when these allegations started coming to light. We're going to have to find some equilibrium there where I think people who maybe have behaved boorishly don't necessarily lose their job immediately, but people who commit assault are held accountable. And so I think it's a cultural discussion that we're going to have, I think, continuing into 2018, where we try to find this balance.
You know, I referenced in the introduction the Women's March in January, a repudiation of, I guess, comments, really, that President Trump had made. The Me Too phenomenon goes way beyond the presidency, but in a sort of odd way, I wonder, George Pyle, did Trump's election force the issue into the public eye and make it maybe less acceptable to look the other way?
Well, I think it has, and I think that probably a lot of the people who have come forward with accusing other people of similar or worse things probably have found the courage to do so because they start to realize that they're not the only one. I mean, this is the same thing with children who have been molested, with women who have been raped, with black people who have experienced racism and things like that. And you look around and people aren't talking about it. And you kind of think, well, I'm the only one. Nobody else ever suffers with this. So I'm just going to suck it up and go on. And then you start to realize that you're not the only one, that there are hundreds and thousands and millions of people who have been through what you've been through. And that can give people the strength. And I'm speaking as somebody who never experienced anything like any of this. I mean, you're talking white privilege. You know, it's sitting right in front of you here. Mm. White male privilege. And so this is totally from the outside looking in, and it's almost like when the Berlin Wall came down. I mean, it's that big
a flood.
Reverberation.
We have to go to a break here in just a moment, but Holly Richardson, circling back to you, are we moving away from that looking the other way that has been kind of the norm? Is this going to stick, I guess, is the question.
I don't know, right? I don't know if it will be just kind of a flash in the pan. I hope that it's not. I hope that we will continue to have not only the conversation, but that we will pay attention and be believing of the victims, as everybody has actually pointed out. I mean, that's a key, instead of blaming and shaming. But I think, you look at the Roy Moore race for Senate, and it was the women who came forward who were blamed and shamed, right? They were the ones that really got a ton of negativity.
Right, through this sort of conspiracy theory.
Sure, right.
But he lost.
He did lose.
At least.
He did lose, right? And there's still ongoing legal action.
I think
from his perspective, right? But I saw a lot of it on social media with this backlash of, okay, well, now this is a political weapon, so we're going to see it used everywhere. Hmm. That's just simply not true, right? Statistics show only 2% of the stories are falsified. Hmm. So let's believe the 98.
Well, the Me Too movement, I'm sure, will be an ongoing story in 2018. Guys, we have to go to our first break of the show, and this is our year in review show with editorial voices from the Salt Lake Tribune. When we return, we will turn to a couple of other big stories from the year, the dismantling of two Utah National Monuments and Operation Rio Grande. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editorial voices Robert Gerke, Michelle Quist, George Pyle, and Holly Richardson. It's our year in review. You can join us with your questions and comments during this Friday morning conversation at sltrib.com, the KCPW Facebook page, or by calling 801-355-8255. Public lands conversations are a big part of any year. This year, though, a dream come true for many political leaders in the state of Utah. President Trump came to town earlier this month and remade two Utah national monuments, the Bear's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante monuments. Robert Gerke, I'll throw this to you first. Was this all about having the ear of the president, the Utah delegation, having that ear, and also about who the president is?
I think both, yes. The Utah delegation was in a position where they were able to put this on the agenda prominently in a way that maybe others might not have been able to. And we're talking again specifically about Senator Hatch, I think.
Yeah.
And then I think was also his inclination to, as he spent most of the first several months of his presidency trying to undo the things that Obama administration had done. And this one that came in near the end of the Obama administration was low-hanging fruit, really. And so they went through this charade of trying to have Secretary Zinke do a review of national monuments that just happened to go back to right before the Grand Staircase was created. So I think the writing was on the wall that whole time. I think the listening tour was pretty transparent charade where he, you know, listened to some people and other people couldn't get a meeting or tried to get a meeting, got 30 minutes of, you know, a distracted secretary. You know, the recommendations from the state were as sweeping or more so than in terms of what they wanted. So they didn't necessarily get everything they wanted. The counties wanted even more reductions than we saw. And so, but you know, ultimately this was going to—it could have been worse. It could have been a complete elimination of the Bears Ears National Monument. I think that was certainly in the realm of possibilities early on. But this is ultimately going to be decided in the courts, and we've got five lawsuits right now: three on Bears Ears, two on Grand Staircase, that are all pending in federal court. And I think the administration is going to have a hard time, particularly with Grand Staircase, as we've discussed here before, particularly with Grand Staircase, making that one stand up, because that one's been in place for 21 years. It's been funded by Congress. The boundaries have been adjusted numerous times by Congress. But the Bears Ears is an open question, because it's never been litigated before the president's authority to shrink it. And we know presidents have shrunk monuments, typically for some national security reason, but it's never been challenged in court. So this is going to be a first a precedental case,
which is happening now. You mentioned Senator Hatch. Would this not have happened without Senator Hatch appealing to the president?
It's hard to say. I mean, President Trump certainly was eager to give Orrin Hatch credit. You know, I did this for you, Orrin, and things like that. So I think Orrin was able to put it into high gear, right? But I think, again, it was right in the wheelhouse of this White House to want to do something. It was something they could do easily with executive order rather than having to work through Congress. It was something they could show concrete results for people in Utah, and also make the case for the extractive industries, oil, coal, and gas, that we're doing something for their constituencies there. So I think it was it's sort of a no-brainer that this was the direction they were going to go.
And the review had already been requested for national monuments to occur. I mean, some of that was probably political, but it's a celebratory mood for Republican political leaders. Michelle Quist, again, despite the divide among residents in the state of Utah, this has been a priority for so many in the political establishment here in Utah. They are pretty happy about this.
They are. In fact, I mean, the legislature has passed numerous resolutions asking for this, and they've spent money finding out, you know, investigating whether it would be a good idea to sue, you know, over these monuments. And I think they definitely, you know, had a congratulatory, yay, look what we did. Yeah. It's interesting that what they were first, like Robert said, what they were first asking for was a repeal. You know, we don't want anything but a repeal. And it slowly kind of changed to, or we want it shrunk. And then we'll, you know, and then we'll win. And so they're claiming victory.
It's been funny listening to the Ken Ivories of the world at the Utah legislature. Ken is one of those take back the lands kind of guys, the leader of that movement up at the Utah legislature. And he's still upset. He still says, well, these monuments are still there. They're still too big. And what was part of the monument before is still federal land, and the locals still don't have a voice. So they're still crusading against this, and they're not necessarily happy with the outcome of this.
Well, and the ultimate goal being a sort of takeover of federal lands. Holly Richardson, your thoughts here. One of the things that kind of struck me about the president's coming and doing this was the short duration of his visit. It was like 3 hours total to make this big change in the state of Utah.
It was all showboating. So, look, I agree. I mean, I think people like the Ken Ivories of the world are the 100% or nothing, right? Is if we don't get 100% of what we're looking for, then we're going to be disappointed and we're not happy. But to Michelle's point, right, we have a lot of people who are willing to say this is quite a victory for the Republican point of view, right? Local control. We undid by executive order what was done by executive order, right? I mean, my complaint with the process is really the process of, if you have the House, the presidency, and the Senate, why not do it legislatively and do things, quote unquote, the right way instead of with a pen and a phone, right?
Universal action. I mean, sorry, executive action, unilateral executive action sort of being the new boogeyman for all sides in this particular topic.
Right.
Guys, we are so low on time. And George, I'm sorry to not give you a chance to comment on the story, but we should, before we turn to the wisdom of Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley, quickly tackle Operation Rio Grande. It was a city, county, state initiative to deal with crime in the Rio Grande neighborhood. It is this initiative. And it kicked off back in August, started with a crackdown on crime. As I said, there have been a lot of arrests. The latest is that we have some federal Medicaid funding that has been approved to come the state's way, thanks to a waiver. Those basics in place, maybe I'll just ask some of these opinion columnists quickly for some opinions. George Pyle, is Operation Rio Grande succeeding?
I think you have to say that it is. I also think you have to compare it. It bothered me that this was cast in military terms, but if you're going to cast it in military terms, you should follow through and you should say, okay, we've liberated Mosul. Now what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And it's now what happens? Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to make a difference as to whether this sticks.
Some criticism of the program came, you know, including from a national sort of expert on homelessness. This is Ian DeJong, and it was that this looked more like an enforcement action, that it was policymakers trying to kind of criminalize their way out of homelessness and poverty, which he says doesn't work. Robert Gerke, what about that argument?
Well, I mean, there's no question that's what it was in the initial stages, and it was a big sweep. It was a military style police sweep where they rounded people up and shipped them out. Ian's absolutely right in that, but I think George is also right that now comes the hard part. Right now, we've got to deal with the rehabilitation aspect of it. Now we've got to deal with the hardest part, which is finding long-term low-income housing in this city, which is an abominably low supply of. And so, right. You know, it's part of what caused the problem in the first place, and now it's got to be the hardest part of finding the solution to it.
I'm going to give it to Michelle for just a quick moment and then to Holly, but Michelle, your thoughts on Operation Rio Grande.
Yeah, building a fence is never good optics, but the success will determine if we can get enough treatment beds.
Holly, what about you?
I live in Utah County, and I've listened to Utah County law enforcement say that some of what was rounded up from Rio Grande came to Utah County and in our canyons. So that's one issue, and the other is, to Robert's point, affordable housing.
Okay. Well, Operation Rio Grande continues on, and you know, we didn't talk about the closure of the Road Home Shelter and how there's some objection to that.
You got some time to do that next year.
Right, exactly. But all of 2018, homeless resource centers that are slated to come online, et cetera. So I'm sorry to have to cut it short, but we're going to have to move on to our final break of the show and then to our underplayed stories of the year. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's George Pyle, Michelle Quist, Robert Gerke, and Holly Richardson. And guys, we barely scratched the surface on 2017. We didn't talk about Nurse Alex Wubbles, Representative Jason Chaffetz, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, the squabble between the Huntsman Cancer Institute at the University of Utah, or the departure of outdoor retailers, or the Salt Lake Tribune's Pulitzer Prize. News-filled year, but I'll just refer people to the Tribune archives and say let's move to our underplayed stories of the year. Michelle Quist, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm always interested in court cases. I think the underplayed issue this year's Supreme Court decision, oral argument of the political gerrymandering and campaign gerrymandering, and if they decide that there is no such thing or that it's not bad, it changes kind of the landscape here in Utah.
We will see. That's a big topic to just suddenly open, so we'll move on.
Throw that out there.
Holly Richardson, pick for underplayed story of the year.
So I think the underplayed story of the year in Utah is the Me Too movement as it relates to Utah's Capitol Hill. So we've talked about it nationally. We've talked about it in general terms, but there are some things that are happening within the Utah political sphere that has not been covered enough.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll look for those stories in 2018. George Pyle, your pick for underplayed story of the year.
Okay. Well, this is the underplayed story of the decade in Utah. Rural America is drying up and blowing away every place. And to point to the fact that we have a lot of federal land and that's the problem, that's just false. Kansas doesn't have any federal land. Oklahoma doesn't have any federal land. Arkansas doesn't have any federal land. And their small towns and rural areas are having exactly the same problems that Utah's is. So you can't blame it on the monuments.
Okay. And Robert Gerke.
George and I need to coordinated this, I guess, because I think the one thing that probably needs more discussion in Utah right now is the climate change and the impacts of climate change on this state. We've seen our winters getting shorter. Our ski industry is about $1.5 billion for the state. They're struggling. If you look up in the mountains now, it's pretty bleak. And then in the summers, you know, we have shortage of water, as George mentioned. We have fires. We have fires that are damaging watersheds. We have bug infestations that are contributed to by this climate change, and I think there's not been enough discussion about that. But there's incremental coverage, but not enough global, broader discussion of that.
Okay. Climate change for Robert Gerke's pick. I'm going to do a little bit of self-congratulation here for the underplayed story of the year. For me, it's KCPW Public Radio having some big wins in its long-term turnaround, a $1.7 million write-off of the bulk of our purchase loan back in July. We're hiring for the first time in quite a while. It's a far healthier organization than it has been for quite a while. And thanks to our listeners for sticking with us.
Good news.
That's my pick. Holly Richardson, Michelle Quist, George Pyle, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here today, and Happy New Year to you all.
Happy New Year.
For the remainder of the show, we are going to turn to a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley for his take on 2017. He joined me in studio earlier this week. Here now is our conversation. Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
The end of 2017 is upon us, and what a year it was.
Oh, yeah.
You produced, I don't know, hundreds of cartoons over 2017?
Yeah, probably I do 250 cartoons over the course of a year.
Okay. Much of the news this year turned on this being the first year of the Trump presidency. You know, stories from Public Lands to Me Too to the tax plan that's happened now, the Mueller investigation, all of that had to do with President Trump in one way or another. How different is being a cartoonist in the year 2017 under the Trump presidency than it was in years prior?
Well, it feels more urgent than it did before, but it felt pretty darn urgent before that as well. You know, I have to go back a couple of decades where I kind of was mailing it in as far as doing cartoons, and that was during the Clinton administration and during the George H.W. Bush administration. And actually, that was a period where it almost didn't matter who was in the White House. You know, they both governed kind of in the center. And then it was when George W. Bush came into the White House, and we got the first taste of what it looked like to govern from the right, from the hard right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the perfect expression of Republicanism. I mean, he cut taxes. He had a very muscular foreign policy. He went to war, drug us into a couple of wars. The way that he responded to 9/11, you know, was exactly the wrong thing to do. And so it felt pretty urgent back then, you know. And then I thought in 2008, you know, they've lanced the boil. You know, we've elected Barack Obama. He's a reasonable person, but it got worse. You saw what happened over the last 8 years. And then Trump. You know, it's just one thing after another. And I would like to say that, you know, I can see light at the end of the tunnel, that it's going to get better. I'm not sure. I just can't see that anymore. I can't say that.
I'm just trying to think of a way to convey. I mean, you did a lot of artwork on the 45th President of the United States. Just here's a thought experiment for you, Pat. If you had to describe the president to someone who had just woken up from a coma or to aliens who were visiting from another planet, which apparently is a thing now. Maybe not. How would you describe President Donald Trump?
Well, you kind of stole it when you said aliens from another planet. I mean, he's kind of like one of the aliens that they dream up for Doctor Who. You know, he's just got this – you get used to him. You know, you look at him and you don't quite realize just how odd, how different the guy looks. I mean, the hair thing, you know, is just – totally bizarre. But the shape of his head, you know, the way that he walks, he's just this lump. But he does have he's got a very expressive face, you know, so you almost can't turn away. You know, when he talks, you never know what he's going to say. He could take us into war. So, you know, he's really good that way. He's driving up ratings. There's no question.
Good material. We're good fodder for your cartoons.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I'm assuming, though, that you would forego those ratings happily.
Oh, yeah. No, this, you know, people say, you know, I bet you just really love this with all the material. And, you know, there's a part of me that does, but it takes a toll. It really does. You know, I wake up in the morning and I'm fine for 5 minutes and then it hits me. You know, I'm living in Trump's America. This guy who bragged about the size of his on national TV got elected president. And here we are.
Of all the Trump-related cartoons that you drew this year, was there one that elicited a particularly strong response, negative or positive? You know, I can think of one where you've got President Trump and Vladimir Putin together, and I think it's Putin who's reaching up the skirt of Lady Liberty.
Oh, they're both doing it. Okay. They're both groping Lady Liberty, and that was before this whole thing about Me Too,
right?
You know, came out. The first cartoon I did. When he was sworn in for president, January 20th, was a picture of Obama saying goodbye to Lady Liberty, you know, giving her an embrace farewell. And he's saying to her, remember those self-defense techniques that I taught you. Mm-hmm. And then off to the side, as you see this little tiny hand, you know, the kind of gropey little hand off to the side.
Well, this is because of comments that Trump was revealed to have made during an Access Hollywood video, leaked audio, talking about being able to grab women. And
you see, we can't even say what he said. No. And this guy is in the White House. He's in, man, he's...
It's an interesting era, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this speaks to that. There's a cartoon that you drew, I'm not exactly certain when in the year, showing a drafting table. And then you've got a cartoonist, presumably you, and your face is planted into the table, and there's a counter on the wall above that reads, 1 days since last Trump cartoon. Does it get tiring drawing this president, or maybe it's the news about the president that you get tired of?
Yeah, I do find that, you know, drawing all Trump all the time just gets really tiring. And so I still do things that are going on that he has an impact on. Like, for instance, this whole tax thing. I've done cartoons about the GOP tax, and it's not reform. You know, let's see what it is. It's borrowing $1 trillion from China and giving it to rich people. So I've done cartoons about that, and I have not put Trump in it, but obviously he's got something to do with it. But I have started to focus on McConnell, on Ryan, on the Republicans around him, on Orrin Hatch, you know, who's becoming a real enabler of all this kind of stuff.
Sort of Trump's champion in D.C.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they just lavished praise on Trump. They figured out that the way to get what you want is to just suck up to him. You know, to Brown knows the guy, and he loves it. He just absolutely loves it.
One thing that we're seeing is the remaking of government in Trump's America. A relatively early cartoon of yours, I think, this year shows cabinet appointees, Trump cabinet picks, and they are running into their respective departments, the buildings represented by them, with suicide vests.
Oh, yeah. Trump is handing out suicide vests to the head of each department, and they're going to the building. They're going to blow it up. And it's proven true, right?
Well, what's the message? I mean, what is it that's happening that you're through the cartoon or showing?
Well, it's a wrecking crew. I mean, they're not about government. They're not about running things. They're about destroying things. You look what they're doing to the EPA, to the Interior Department, to education. It's all about dismantling. It's all about blowing it up.
We don't have time to go through every news story that broke this year or even through, you know, a tenth of the cartoons that you drew. The Harvey Weinstein revelations and the societal awakening about sexual harassment and assault, that was a big story. How did you take that in, and what has struck you about the story, Pat Bagley?
You know, actually, I got a head start on this because the Salt Lake Tribune won a Pulitzer this year.
Right.
It was for a story that we did the previous year about sexual assault at BYU.
Yeah.
And how if you were a victim, you were victimized a second time by the administration who assumed that you somehow had it coming. But they won a Pulitzer for that, right? And so I started doing cartoons about sexual harassment, you know, over a year ago. And then it bleeds over into 2017 and Harvey Weinstein. And, geez, everybody is, you know, getting hit.
And there is, of course, a Trump tie-in there as well. Going back to the topic of the year, it seems like the presidency of Donald Trump, in that there are accusations against him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, lots and lots of accusations. Mm. And not only that, again, we're talking about the Access Hollywood tape. He admitted it. You know, he bragged about assaulting women.
You know, one of the things that this whole movement, the Me Too movement, has made me aware of is how little I, as a man, and this is a definition of privilege, mm-hmm. have to deal with this. But, mm-hmm. I mean, this is also the definition of inequality, in that so many women are dealing with it on so regular a basis.
Yes, it's a moment of education for us, you know, for guys.
Yeah.
I have been at the Tribune for a long, long time, almost 40 years. And back in the day, the women who worked at the Tribune were either secretaries or they worked on the society page, and that was it. And the first women who broke into the photo department, you know, being reporters, into this old boys club, you know, the stories that they would tell me about being harassed by these old guys there who, that's just what you did. I mean, it was the Mad Men era. You know, they were the pioneers and they suffered a lot. Apparently, it's still there.
The reporting you mentioned that your colleagues did at the Tribune, who won the Pulitzer Prize related to sexual assault on Utah college campuses, it kind of brings me again. It has circles back again to this same topic. Trump, the president, in February and on multiple occasions has referred to the media as the enemy of the people,
mm-hmm.
and that's you and your colleagues. Do you and your Tribune coworkers take that personally? Do you, I guess, Pat Bagley, take that personally?
Well, it's not like we get together and we get really angry and mad and, you know, pound the table about it. But these people are professionals. You know, they take a lot of pride in what they do. If they get a fact wrong, it is just devastating to them. You know, they want to get the story right. That's what they do. They've been trained to do that. And to have this buffoon, you know, get up there, the guy can't not lie. I mean, he's just a pathological liar. And to attack us for being, you know, fake news and getting things wrong, it is insulting. I take a lot of pride in that I've taken a lot of effort to learn things. You know, I've read books, I've talked to people, I've listened to podcasts. If I'm interested in something, I will look into it. You know, and to have somebody who knows absolutely nothing make all the knowledge that I've accumulated worthless just because he's an entertainer, that's pretty aggravating. You know, that does make me angry.
And he does it in a tweet.
In a tweet, yeah. He just does it in a tweet. But he enables everybody else who is kind of a numbnuts to, you know, do the same thing.
An item that I definitely want to get to is that this year tragically included the largest mass shooting in modern American history in Las Vegas. This happened in October. And Pat Bagley, as a cartoonist, how do you approach tragedy? Is it hard to weigh in when the wound to the country is so fresh? It's a repeating story, one that is predictable even, I guess, and is bound to happen again.
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure out how to approach it so that you wake people up to just how, you know, horrible this whole thing is. You know, if they weren't going to respond to, 25 kids being shot at Sandy Hook, if that didn't do it as far as implementing some kind of, you know, real gun control, what is? What's going to get through to people? You know, and there were, 50 people killed in Las Vegas by this one shooter? 500 people wounded? Is that right? I mean, we're talking about people whose lives have been destroyed, you know, people whose lives are forever changed, who are going to be on disability. You know, they're going to be, part of the medical system and not for anything that they did. But it's going to cost us a lot of money just so that this guy can go in and buy all the guns he wants.
This is not the first time and won't be the last time, again, that you draw about a mass shooting in America. You point a lot of blame at the gun lobby.
Oh, I mean, the NRA, absolutely. And the NRA is nothing but a front for the gun manufacturers. And if you, this is how sick we are, is that every time we have one of these mass shootings, the stock prices of these gun manufacturers shoot up because they know that people are going to go out, they're going to figure out which gun was used in this mass murder, and they're going to go buy it. And it happens time after time after time. It happened again after this Las Vegas shooting.
And because of the fear that particular weapon is going to be removed from the market because of the fact that it was involved in a mass shooting, which has not borne out, by the way.
Well, I can't get into the head of these people and why they do it. It makes absolutely no sense. When I travel overseas, and I was in South Korea this last year, and I was in France this last year, and, you know, these people, they go, what is wrong with you? They hear about these mass shootings, they hear about the violence, and to them, it's clear. You know, you make it hard to get a gun. If you want to get a gun, you've got to pass tests, you've got to, you know, really be dedicated, you've got to show that you're not crazy. Here in America, any idiot can buy a gun.
What's the purpose of political cartoons? There's something different about being, you talk about trying to wake people up, but there's something different about getting it through that cartoon medium as opposed to anything else. Why do you do it, and what is the purpose? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, okay, there are three things that I try to do in a cartoon, and one is to educate, you know, show people, well, this is an issue that maybe you'll be interested in. Maybe they don't know a lot about it, and I can throw facts out there. Like, for instance, that the recreation industry in Utah is worth $8.5 billion. And the oil and gas and polluting industries are worth, I think this last year was around $3 billion. So a lot less. You know, I'm trying to educate people that preserving our wild lands makes sense economically, right? Okay, so there's education. I'm trying to persuade people. So I'm trying to frame the issue so that people go, oh, I see what you mean. You know, that makes sense.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm trying to do is kind of entertain. It's a spoonful of sugar, you know, makes the medicine go down. If I just flogged people all the time, you know, trying to make them see I was right and blah, blah. No, but if it's funny, then you get people coming to, they like looking at the cartoon.
Huh. I often think about cartoons also being something, an instance in where you know, you look at a cartoon by Pat Bagley and you think about something in a way that you haven't thought about it before. So in addition to just educating, it can be having a turn or making a parallel that sometimes people wouldn't think of, but when you make the parallel, I can't give you an exact example right now, suddenly it all becomes clear to you, the issue resolves for you.
Oh, yeah. Like, for instance, you know, trying to explain the very complex GOP tax bill. You know, you can go into the weeds and, you know, who gets what, the pass-throughs and blah, blah, blah. Well, if you just call it a smash and grab for the rich, people get that. So,
and then finally, Pat, What are your wishes, I guess, for 2018, since this is a looking back and looking ahead show? What do you want to be drawing about in 2018?
Well, I guess that I would wish that the left in the country, that the progressives in the country actually hone their message, that they understand what they're about and why they're doing it, and that we're really all in this together. But they've been really bad at messaging and trying to explain what they're all about. The right doesn't have that problem.
Is the left, you talk about honing that message, is it fighting with itself instead of fighting with, the powers that be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the left is always really good at tearing itself apart. It was true in the Spanish Civil War when they were fighting the fascists as they were too busy fighting each other to, you know, put up a united front. There's a story I tell. It's a true story about when Rome, in 70 AD, the Romans put Jerusalem under siege. And so there were all these Romans around the walls of Jerusalem, and there were a million Jews inside the walls of Jerusalem. And there were factions within. And the Romans are outside watching this, and they're watching Jews throw each other off the walls of Jerusalem. Hmm. You know, so in a way, they were doing their job for them.
And that's the American left?
That's the American left, pretty much. Is, you know, here we are surrounded by fascists. I mean, honest to God, fascists. And we're, you know, still fighting about Bernie and Hillary and... And now there's that left-wing socialist candidate or green candidate, Stein. Is that her name?
Yeah, Jill Stein.
Yeah, Jill Stein's in the news now, and it's all a distraction.
Hmm. Pat Bagley, editorial cartoonist for the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining me today.
Okay, well, if you can make sense of that.
That's Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley and his take on the contentious, tumultuous, news-filled year that was 2017. And that does it for our year in review here on Behind the Headlines. Thanks very much to KCPW's Jesse Ellis for a year's worth of radio magic. Thanks to our partners at UPR and Logan who broadcast this show across the state. To the show's producer, Emily Means, and to the Salt Lake Tribune for the remarkable reporting they did this year. I'm Roger McDonough, and you have been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Have a happy new year, and we'll see you again in 2018.